Here's an experiment for you. Take passionate experts in human resource technology. Invite cross-industry experts from inside and outside HR. Mix in what's happening in people analytics today. Give them the technology to connect. Hit record. Pour their discussions into a beaker. Mix thoroughly, and voila, you get the HR Data Labs podcast, where we explore the impact of data and analytics to your business. We may get passionate and even irreverent, but count on each episode challenging and enhancing your understanding of the way people data can be used to solve real-world problems. Now, here's your host, David Turetsky.
Hello and welcome to the HR Data Labs podcast. I'm your host, David Turetsky, and with me, like always, my trusted friend and partner from Salary.com, Dwight Brown. Hey, Dwight, how are you?
I'm good, David. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay, although it's rather cold outside, but we're not going to let that stop us from having a really good time. Because today, we have on a really brilliant person who I had the pleasure of working with for a very long time in my career. And to say this person was a mentor and a friend, I think kind of downplays it. But today we have on Don Weinstein, who had been kind of, you could think of him as the strategy guy gone HR. And Don, I want you to give a little bit more background on yourself, but hopefully that doesn't take away the fact that you've accomplished a tremendous amount in your career.
Well, that's kind of you, David. And it was a long career, so I hope I can accomplish something, you know, 35 years in the Fortune 500. But, you know, certainly in more than half that time in HR. And really, I think it was a great run for me, certainly at ADP for many years, where you and I worked together and we had a lot of fun with data there, as we always like to say. Data was our middle name, and we just had to bring it to fruition.
Yes. And we're going to have a lot of chance to talk about that today. But Don, what's one fun thing that no one knows about you?
Other than the fact that I'm not that much fun.
It's not true.
Not true. I don't do a lot, but I will say, like, you know, I've had my share. I talked about 35 years in the Fortune 500, but before that started, I had my share of really odd jobs when I was growing up. Anything to make a dollar. You know, summer breaks. Right. You know, after school jobs. So I was a busboy. I actually worked the grill at a Sizzler restaurant. That's where I learned how to cook. I painted houses. I even spent one summer working in a sand mine. Yes, that is a real sand mine. That is a real thing. We mined sand Australia.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So
that's where it comes from.
Yeah. Well, for, you know, industrial applications, absolutely. You need high grade, high quality sand, and nothing better than an 18-year-old with a shovel to get to that.
So when someone tells you to pound sand, You actually know how to do that.
I did pound my fair share of sand.
Yes, you certainly did.
Yes, I did.
I was going to ask, Don, so you didn't actually go to the beach, take a truck, and just kind of shovel sand into the truck from the beach?
Don stole the beach.
Beach would have been nice. That would have been a much better working environment than the types of places like the bottom of a sand pit or a sand wash, as we used to call it. Yeah, it's good. Wow. Like, I always say that, like, that's real work. All this other stuff that, you know, I've been doing ever since, you know, that'll teach you to know the value of an honest, hard day's work.
But the Sizzler, you know, I don't know if you ever saw the movie Waiting with Ryan Reynolds.
Oh, sure. Love it.
That came to my mind. That never happened, right? That stuff that happened in Waiting, that stuff never really did occur, right?
Nah, we'll leave it like that. Yeah, that never happened.
There you go. We're going to leave it right there. So our topic for today is one that's very near and dear to Don and my heart. And Dwight, I know that you love this too. This is kind of the reason why we actually started the HR Data Labs podcast, which is talking about data and the journey that companies need to go on and how it works for you. And so, Don, I know what we want to do today is talk a little bit about the journey that even we took when we were at ADP of making data actually into insight.
Yeah, for sure. And for me, it goes back, you know, to the beginning. So I skipped over a little bit in my background, but I was an engineer by trade. I actually started my career as an aeronautical engineer working for General Electric Aerospace on things like GPS, right? So
wow, really? You're a rocket scientist is what you're saying.
Yeah, you could say that. I tend not to, but I was an engineer. So, you know, people always ask like, hey, you know, engineering to the world of payroll and HR, that's quite a leap, but you know, there are a few stops in between. But when I came into the world of human capital management, it was surprising to me, again, coming from a data-centric world like engineering, how under-leveraged data was in the practice of human capital management. And, you know, in particular, I think there were a lot of other functions, not just engineering, but other enterprise functions mm-hmm. that were in the process. And, you know, we're going back like, you know, two decades now, that we're in the process of being completely transformed by analytics. I think about sales and marketing as a good parallel. And, you know, there used to be that old marketing adage about, well, you know, I know half my marketing spend is wasted, but I just don't know which half. And look, in the pre-digital world, in the analog world of things like billboards and, you know, remember buying Yellow Pages ads, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. compared to where we are today, where I'm buying keywords on Google and I know to a fraction of a penny what my cost per click, what my click-through rate is, what my cost per customer acquisition, you name it. And I saw the way that analytics was transforming other enterprise functions. And it just seemed like HR was behind the curve. And not only was HR behind the curve in that, in terms of limited use of analytics, but a lot of the limited analytics that were out there that were being peddled at the time was bad analytics. It was a lot of junk science. Right. Sometimes I use the term malpractice out there. It was quite embarrassing. And so we saw an opportunity. We thought we could do something to change that and change it for the better.
I don't know if you remember this, but there was one client that we worked on in particular who had invested millions in trying to create HR dashboards. And they basically were taking all their data, dumping it out into a data lake, essentially, and trying to actually give managers a view into the data. And they would literally give these HR dashboards to managers without any insight, without any training, without any context at all. And they got back a gigantic thud. You just wasted $2 million. Mm-hmm. And so one of the lessons we took from that is don't repeat that and be at least a little thoughtful in how you're developing this and how you're delivering it, right?
That's exactly right. I mean, I think there were so many lessons we learned in the early days. And, you know, we were rolling out data tools and data products, you know, starting like almost 15 years ago. So mm-hmm. we've been at this for a little while. But yeah, a few things really jumped out at me. You know, first was, I think, just how bad some of the data in human capital management systems actually is. You know, things like job titles and position descriptions. I think inside my own organization, we had like 1.5 job titles per person, as an example.
That's actually not bad.
Yeah, I'm sure you've seen a lot worse, but yep. I mean, how do you operate in a world like that where you have more job titles than actual people working? It's mind-boggling. Skills data, another area, is just so fraught with just bad data. I'll still remember we did, and that was coming out of the technology organization, where we did a skills survey. Mm-hmm. And you know, like the world of technology evolves very quickly. And so it's not a bad idea to say, hey, let's just make sure we do an inventory of what people know and what people don't know. But the survey design was so bad and it was so painful that I remember going through it myself. And I was just a participant at the time thinking, how do I get through this as quickly as possible? And what I realized, first of all, was anytime I checked yes, it asked me a follow-on question where it wanted more information. So I was like, well, I don't want to do any of that. So I just said no to everything. I have no skills whatsoever. Other people spent like, well, you know, it's a little bit of a risky move, I grant you, but it was that painful. And like, I know other people who went, you know, completely the other direction, spent hours and hours and hours trying to document all these skills that they had, which of course, even if it was accurate, was going to be out of date within 6 months. Mm-hmm. And then they asked me to follow on question. Well, right. What did we ever do with that? Zero. Nothing. Like, well, so, I remember, so bad.
I remember when that happened. And I think one of the interesting things is even before it got finalized, the survey got finalized, technology changes were happening so rapidly that you just basically had to call it a day and send it out, because otherwise you would constantly be evolving the survey and never actually collect anything.
Exactly. And again, and even that which you collected was, you know, not terribly valid. You were asking people to, you know, self-assess, and maybe they were, maybe they weren't the best assessors of themselves. Then they asked managers to validate the people's self-assess. Like, I have no idea, you know, like everything that you know, I might know what you're working on for me today, but you've worked on more than that. So data was so poor, and it still is today. But there was an exception to that rule, and that was payroll data. Right? Yeah. Payroll data is the one thing that we know is digitally accurate to the fraction of a penny, because if it's ever not, it's effectively, it's crowdsourced. Yeah. It's crowdsourced, right? Because the crowd will tell you if it's right or
you're going to get that
wrong.
Angry call that, hey, you were off by 25 cents on my check. So
yes, up to the second, and accurate to the fraction of a penny. So, you know, I think we spent a lot of time there. And to your point about making sure it not landing with a thud, I think the focus were, what are those things that we incontrovertibly know to be true? Like, there are a lot of things, skills, positions, et cetera, very wishy-washy out there. But I could tell you things about employment levels, about income. And so, as you know, we talked about the compensation benchmark was probably the most popular of those early things that we rolled out, because it was true, it was accurate, and it was valuable. And if people, you know, the transparency aspect of it was useful. Mm-hmm. And then transparency wise, people are saying, well, where'd you get that from? Oh, I got 26 million paid people out here. So I know a little something about it.
Across industry, across geography, across company size. So you could literally, if you needed to, narrow down your focus and be more specific about what and who you're paying.
That's right. Which is enormously valuable. I mean, you think about it, like, you have a lot of organizations out there who on the one hand, you know, don't have good insights into what's happening in compensation trends. Certainly the last few years that we've been through, right, where we've seen, you know, you go through these periods where in some cases compensation is somewhat stable and static, and you don't see a lot of dramatic movement, you know, month to month or even year to year. But then I look at the last 2 to 3 years and we're getting these wild swings that were happening. Mm-hmm. And people are looking like, I have a compensation survey, to your point, you know, maybe they were getting it from some third party out there. But it's from a year ago. Like, I don't know, how good is it? It's changed a lot in a year. And so I think that was the other thing that was amazing about the payroll data. It's self-updating every week, every 2 weeks. You're getting near real-time kind of feedback. So I think that was one of the things that we did early on that was really exciting, is that we found sources of data that were, you know, they were unique, they were valuable, they were trustworthy. We could be transparent about it. To your point, we could show you all the underlying factors that went into it. I think transparency was a key learning for us early on as well. Like, people, I guess the world of HR analytics had maybe a poor reputation, in part because of some of the, you know, the other poor sources of data out there that we've talked about. And so being able to come out and say, like, here's the data set. Let me unpack it for you. Let me show you all the sources so that you can have more confidence in it, was a big step forward, I think, for the practice of HR analytics.
But I think one of the other things you mentioned, though, actually gave it more credence, which is that payroll is derived from this data, whereas we both know that HR data is flawed and that there's lots of errors built into it because we're not keeping this up to date as fast as we should. The analytics that they're using came from their payroll system. So if they trust their payroll data, then they should trust the analytics that are coming out the other side. So there was that. And if it didn't, we helped them fix it, or we showed them how to fix it, which made it feel more comfortable on the way out.
Exactly right. Exactly right. Trust is so important in this area. And that became a key differentiator. And that's what I think was critical to the acceptance of that analytics.
Like what you hear so far? Make sure you never miss a show by clicking subscribe. This podcast is made possible by Salary.com. Now, back to the show.
what were some of the other critical lessons that we learned when we were actually going through from the early stages? And you talked about some, but what were other lessons that we learned when we started the HR analytics journey?
Well, I think the fact that, and you alluded to this, is about the need for help in rolling these things out. The function tends to be underpopulated by STEM graduates, right? And so our clients needed help, first of all, with just getting good data and knowing what good data is and what it isn't, and then with interpreting it, and then finally driving utilization. I just as the whole area evolved, there was appetite and there was interest, but maybe the appetite and interest exceeded the capability inside the organizations that we were working with, just because it was relatively new and not a lot of people had a lot of history and learning with it. And that's where we collaborated, I think, quite nicely in building the professional services practice around not just, hey, let me roll out some interesting stuff here, but let me work with my clients to help them understand how to actually use it. And then taking that to the next level, I think probably my favorite learning in all of this was the notion of pushing the information as deep into the organization as we could. Because one of the other challenges that I think I saw with many implementations of HR analytics was that it was being kind of contained within the HR organization, which has some value, right? Some value, no doubt. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, where do most of the people decisions get made? They actually get made in the field by the managers and the supervisor. I'm talking about, who do I hire? How much should I pay them? Right. Whom should I promote? Any kind of decision like that could be enhanced with analytics. Well, if you've got all the analytics sitting kind of captive in a central shared service, it's not going to be democratized out to the masses. Exactly. It's not going to be put in the hands of the people making the decisions in the moment of truth. So what we found was really going from that world of, hey, we've got these cool dashboards over here that some people could use, to actually embedding the analytic information right in the hands of the users at the moment of truth. So think about, we talked about compensation benchmarks, obviously very useful for the compensation department of an organization. How about if I'm in a recruiting workflow and I want to make an offer letter and I'm right there at the point of making an offer, pop me up the comp benchmark right there and give it to the user who's responsible. Yeah. So I think that was the critical learning of them all, the most impactful one.
And I would imagine that was a partial culture shift too, because oftentimes in organizations, the people who work with the data, who curate the data, tend to be very protective of it. And you oftentimes hear, what do you need? I will give it to you because you wouldn't know what to do with the data if I gave it to you, you know? And it sounds like you kind of had that culture shift. You probably went through education, all of the follow-on pieces that get you to that democratization that you talked about.
Dwight, you could not be more right about that. It was cultural in some respects. People were protective of the data. That's a nice way to say it. Sometimes they were hoarding the data, right? It's a little bit of, could be a little bit of job security enmeshed in that. Like, I'm the data person here, right? What do you mean you're going to hand this all out? And can we trust people with it? But clearly, if you want to get the maximum impact out of it, and you move from analytics to insights to action, and at the end of the day, you want decisions and actions, you have to put it in the hand of the people who are making the decisions. But not everybody was comfortable. Not everybody was comfortable. You were spot on, Dwight.
Even now, though, Don, when I'm dealing with clients, in fact, every single day I deal with clients who are trying to get this information in the hands of managers, there's a technology issue, there's a permissions issue, and there's a culture issue that we have to overcome. Sometimes the technology doesn't allow them to do what they'd like to do. Sometimes the way they have permission set up don't allow them to do that. And sometimes it's just their culture of, I can't give this out to these people. I want to, but I can't, because of the ways in which not only is the data structured, our hierarchies aren't right in ADP or in any other system. Mm-hmm. But so they have to overcome those as well. And so I know you dealt with the technology issues a lot. What kind of cultural change did this have to, did you have to overcome actually selling this internally to the businesses that you were trying to drive to actually get that decision to actually, let's push this out to those managers?
Yeah, that's a fair observation. You're right. There was a lot of technology behind the scenes. I'm glad you mentioned permissions, because you know we spent an incredible amount of time on that to get that right in terms of what you can see and what you can't see. But like right. all of these, and it's true for probably most technologies, it's those things are technical hurdles that can be overcome. The cultural is by far the most challenging. And really, you know, we put it in the hands of, hey, let's make HR the hero here.
Right.
We hear this time and time again, you know, HR wants a seat at the table, needs a seat at the table, deserves a seat at the table. Well, I will tell you, one of the main differences between the organizations where I see that happening and the organizations where I don't, it is the data. And if you're viewed as an organization with low quality, low utilization data, you know, nobody's really that excited about hearing, you know, a bunch of opinions proffered around.
Right. They don't take you seriously. Yeah.
They don't take you seriously. And why should they? Right? Why should they? Conversely, you know, when you have the facts and you have the analytics and you have the data and you can make a real impact in an organization, and then you can back it up. And, you know, we'll talk about some examples there. Like you talk about compensation benchmarking. I can show an impact where, hey, here's how much money we saved because we were able to right size our compensation structures because we had the benchmarks. I'm speaking in the language of the rest of the organization. I'm right. speaking in the language of profit and loss, as opposed to, you know, when HR gets sometimes an unfair reputation as being a fluffier type of function. And when you're coming with the analytics and the facts and the data, you know, you can puncture that old tape and earn the seat at the table. And I think that was the key to really overcoming that cultural impediment, in my view.
Hey, are you listening to this and thinking to yourself, man, I wish I could talk to David about this? Well, you're in luck. We have a special offer for listeners of the HR Data Labs podcast, a free half-hour call with me about any of the topics we cover on the podcast or whatever is on your mind. Go to salary.com/HRDL consulting to schedule your free 30-minute call today. Let me take this a little different direction, along the same lines, but a little different. And let me put it in terms of maturity. And so let's talk about the maturity of the HR function to be able to not just utilize analytics to be able to drive the business, but also what do you see in the future? So it's a two-part question. How do you see it today? Where's the maturity today on HR analytics? Where do you see them driving these kinds of insights in the future?
Yeah, no, it's a fair question. And I do think we're still in the early phases of maturity. Need to see more STEM graduates going into HR analytics, need to see more STEM content being pushed into HR, you know, programs, whether it's university or continuing education. I do notice some folks who are going after those, you know, postgraduate certifications and the like. And I think those are great from a continuing learning perspective. Those are still more the exception to the rule from my observation. I'd like to see more of that. I feel like the awareness much, much higher. So we've made great progress on the awareness. I think the interest is much higher, but many organizations are still suffering from limited adoption.
Yep.
And one of the things that's really still hindering them is poor data quality. And that's changing in some areas, but I think one of the challenges you have, again, if you have folks in the function who don't have a good fundamental understanding of the data, like who is the steward of the HR data of the organization, then you're going to struggle with poor quality. The poor quality will lead to low adoption. And until we can get that one really figured out, I think we're still going to be lagging the other functional areas who have much better stewardship of their data.
Do you see that coming from the head of HR? Do you see that coming from the head of payroll? Do you see that coming from another, like the CFO? Who is that steward who has to stand up and say, we require HR to do this for us?
Ultimately, it has to be the head of HR. It can come from other areas, but I think for the function to make the kind of leap that I would like to see it make, I think that the head of HR has to be the ultimate steward of the HR data. And if it's, by the way, I'll tell you who it's not. And I say this as a former head of technology, it's not the head of technology. I'm not trying to wash my hands of this thing, but it just can't be.
Right.
It needs to be owned by the function, because they're the ones who have to take ownership, but then derive the value at the end of the day. And I've seen too many organizations where they try to push that more towards, well, that's a CIO type function. Well, right. The CIO can help, mm-hmm. for sure. They have a role to help, but the ultimate steward of the data of any function has to be the leader of that function, right? Who's the steward of the marketing data? It has to be the CMO.
Right.
Who's the steward of the sales data? And again, they'll have people who help them, right? But I'm talking about the A in the RACI matrix. Who's got the A has to be the head of HR.
Yeah. And definitely insistence from the business units too, which gets to your adoption question that you've talked about. Once you've got enough credibility and adoption out there, then they also help, like you talked about, they help become champions and help the head of HR to be that steward.
It's the virtuous circle.
Right, exactly.
But you have to seed it, is the problem, right? So it's a virtuous circle. You're 100% right. Because if you create good, if you get good data and you create good analytics and you push it out to the field, people will use it. And the people who use it will see the value in it. And they will therefore participate in that virtuous circle of getting you more good data. And the vicious circle on the opposite side is you put crappy data out there. Nobody uses it. They shun it and it just gets worse. But so how do you kickstart that? You have to seed it somehow. It's not going to be the functions necessarily who are going to be the ones to seed. It's going to be HR. Where I've seen that in my experience, where I've seen the best implementations, it's been where the head of HR is the steward of the data, has a vision for how they want to use it, takes accountability for producing good quality, and then pushes it out of their operation, doesn't hoard it in the HR analytics group,
right?
Pushes it out. And then people use it, embrace it, and contribute back. That's the pattern.
Yeah.
But what's the next step, Don? Where does this go from here? So we get STEM graduates coming into HR. We get the technology and the data all sorted. We get HR becoming the steward. What happens to HR analytics then? Does it just fall in line with where all the marketing and the sales analytics and all the other, the CFO-based analytics, does it go that direction, or is it something else?
First of all, I do think it should follow the pattern of other functions, right? Why should HR, be different? Think about the finance function. I mean, they have analytics for their own purposes, but they push lots of analytics out into the field. I can tell you, when I was a functional leader, I got plenty of analytics pushed my way from the finance function. Of course, there's some that you want to contain for yourself. But I don't know why HR should be different than any other function. And where we go from here, I think it's really a couple of different spots. So first of all, there's still a data cleanup effort that hasn't yet happened at scale. Mm-hmm. And it needs to happen. And the way that takes place is it's going to be a two-part play. Like, one, we have to do a better job of training future HR leaders, both the ones who are going through the programs in the universities today, as well as, postgraduate and with certificate and other programs, in data aware. It doesn't mean they have to be like PhD mathematicians, but they have to have just a good understanding of data and understanding data quality. There is a data cleanup effort that still has to happen out there in many organizations. And in particular, as you think about the future and the impact that artificial intelligence can have on, again, every function, HR is no different. I think AI is going to have a huge impact on HR analytics, just like every other enterprise function. But, my point of view is the algorithms will come and go, but it's the underlying data quality that will be the differentiator here. Said differently, if you had two vendors who were talking to you about, solutions they had, AI solutions, and one had a decent algorithm, but it had been trained on a pristine data set, and the other one had a whiz-bang algorithm, but it had been trained on a poor data set, which one would you be more likely to believe?
Oh, definitely.
Right? Yeah. And so I think the algorithms will come and go. AI will continue to evolve. People don't realize, like, ChatGPT, you know, was version 3.5 of OpenAI. Right. You know, we're on, and now it's ChatGPT-4. So we're on the fourth generation. This has been building for a long time.
Right.
It will continue to evolve.
Yeah.
It will continue to get better. But it'll only go as far as your underlying data quality will take you. And I think that's kind of the dirty little secret in HR analytics, and the organizations that pay attention to it and that take ownership of their data and steward it through are going to be the ones who ultimately prevail with having the best quality in the future.
Well said. Dom, thank you very much. It was just an insightful conversation. It is always a pleasure to talk to you, but now everyone else will learn from how brilliant you are and how cool it is to actually have you, you know, be able to help them understand the world of HR and HR analytics. So thank you so much for being on the HR Data Labs podcast.
Oh, my goodness. My pleasure. And always great to chat with you and catch up. And Dwight, it was a pleasure meeting you as well.
Definitely a pleasure. I always love the opportunity to hang with fellow data geeks, especially at the end of the week like we're at. And it's been great. So thank you.
What better way to spend a Friday afternoon, right? It's this.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
We should be having beers right now. I don't know.
Well, so for all our listeners, open up your favorite can of whatever. I've got coffee here. And cheers. Take care and thank you and stay safe.
That was the HR Data Labs podcast. If you liked the episode, please subscribe. And if you know anyone that might like to hear it, please send it their way. Thank you for joining us this week, and stay tuned for our next episode. Stay safe.